show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271 3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello, and thank you for being with me for the program today. Welcome to those who have not tuned in to Buddhism on Air before, and for those who have, I hope you've had a fruitful and happy week since we last met. We're on the last stages of discussing the dedication chapter of A Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life by the Indian master Shantideva. And last week, we ended the program with the verses, "May monks desiring to practice find quiet and solitary places, and through having abandoned all wandering thoughts, may they meditate with flexible minds. May nuns be materially sufficient, abandon quarreling with each other, and be unharmed. Similarly, may all ordained ones never let their morality weaken. Having repented any moral falls, may evil always be eradicated, and thereby obtaining a happy state of birth, may spiritual conduct not decline even there." In discussing the verse, "May monks desiring to practice find quiet and solitary places, and through having abandoned all wandering thoughts, may they meditate with flexible minds," you may remember, if you were with us, that we talked about the three solitudes one needs for retreat. The first is the outer solitude of the physical environment, meaning a solitary place away from all distractions and activities. The next is the inner solitude of one's body, which refers to meditating and practicing alone without any company, to reduce disturbing emotions like attachment and so on. And the third solitude is the secret solitude of the mind, that is, keeping the mind quiet and focused on the retreat meditations. The great teacher Trulshi Grimshay says, "The first two kinds of solitude, the outer solitude of the place and the inner solitude of one's own body, are really just supports for the third kind of solitude, which is the secret solitude within one's own mind. This is the most important of the three. Even if we stay in a remote place, if we're caught up in all kinds of thoughts and emotions within our minds, it does not really help us to be in an isolated location. Similarly, we might be alone with the inner kind of solitude and isolation, but if our habits are so strong that we spend all our time thinking about our work and considering our own business affairs or daydreaming about the office, it does not help us to be in isolation, and there's no benefit to being on our own. The most important of the three, therefore, is the secret solitude within the mind. The greater control we gain over our concentration, the more flexible both mind and body become, and so more blissful. In fact, calm abiding is defined in the Tibetan Buddhist teachings as a state of complete mental and physical bliss, brought on by pliancy or flexibility of body and mind. This is why Shantideva wishes monks in retreat to be able to meditate with flexible minds. And now, before we continue looking at the other verses, let's set our motivation as we usually do. Please motivate that this program becomes a cause for you to attain enlightenment, particularly if you can, to benefit all beings, or if that's all too much, to free yourself from sufferings of all sorts. Thank you. In the verse talking about nuns, Shantideva wishes them to be materially sufficient, abandon quarreling with each other, and be unharmed. To understand this verse, we should remember that in times not so long from our own, it was considered in Buddhist spiritual terms to be a great liability to be born in a female body. Still today, in more remote regions, this belief lingers on, and in 2004, Kim Gatsau wrote a book, Being a Buddhist Nun, The Struggle for Enlightenment in the Himalayas, about her experiences living for years with the Tibetan Buddhist nuns of Zanskar. A reviewer of the book, Rita M. Gross, in the journal Buddhist Christian Studies, notes that what the nuns have to put up with, as described by Gatsau. Gross writes, This book is based on 14 years of fieldwork in Zanskar, which is in the Western Himalayas near Kashmir and Ladakh. The author lived in local monasteries while doing her fieldwork. Thus, this account narrates the contemporary condition in which some Buddhist women live. Beginning with the absolute preference for a male body, everything conspires against nuns and women. And there are no success stories of women who somehow transcend all these barriers in this book. Regarding the desirability of a male rebirth, Gatsar writes, "The bottom line is clear. No Buddhist in her right mind desires a female body." As we read of the nuns' lives and of women's lives in general, the reasons for this conclusion quickly become clear. If a girl or woman becomes a nun, she receives little recognition or celebration of her status from either her village or her family. Donations to nunneries are meager, and as a result, it takes nuns many more years to build their cells and assembly halls than it takes monks. Donations given to a monk are considered to produce more merit for the donor than a similar donation to a nun. Gatsar's book focuses on the relevance of nuns in the tantric practices, rituals, and initiations that so characterizes Tibetan Buddhism. And Gross writes, "Rituals performed by monks are considered more efficacious and meritorious than those performed by nuns. Hence, when villages require ritual services for which a donation will be made, they're much less likely to ask the nuns to perform the rituals. Education for nuns is quite limited. Because nuns often have to take employment doing manual labor or housework to earn enough money for their supplies or to build their cells, opportunities for them to perform their meditation practices are also limited. For many of the nuns, the female Yidam Vajragini is their main meditation deity. Nevertheless, they cannot transmit this practice or initiate other nuns to do the meditation. Even if they have completed the required number of mantra recitations, they cannot perform the fire puja, called burnt offering in the book, themselves, but must have a monk perform it on their behalf. The final liability faced by the nuns is that it is generally believed that enlightenment is not possible in a female body anyway. So, in vicious circular reasoning, why educate or support the nuns anyway? The list of liabilities seems endless." Now, of course, the Dalai Lama has often stated that women are as capable as men of leading a fulfilling spiritual life and attaining enlightenment, even as a reply to a question by Gatsar herself. But we cannot deny that nuns traditionally have had a much more difficult time of it than monks, even though there's now some change, as noted by Gross when quoting an international conference held in Ladakh in 1995. She writes, "Local audiences were impressed by the nuns and laypeople from all over the Buddhist world who came to this conference, and as a result, more nunneries were founded and opportunities for nuns began to increase, especially owing to the leadership of energetic younger local nuns. And many Westerners who have become Buddhist nuns are working hard to improve the conditions for their kind throughout the world." This is the context for Shantideva's dedication. Though I don't know whether in his time nuns were considered more prone to quarreling and argument, and that's why he says they should abandon quarreling. Kunzen Peldon, in his commentary, The Nectar of Manjushri's Speech, seems to interpret the word unharmed to refer to broken discipline. "May nuns have little difficulty in acquiring their robes and provisions. May they never be quarrelsome and always have undamaged discipline. Peaceful, self-controlled, and conscientious, may they remain in the supreme Dharma," he writes. And then continues, "In the same way, may all those who, wishing for liberation, have embraced the monastic state, be able to uphold at all times, and according to their pledge, a pure and unimpaired observance of the extraordinary qualities of the path of liberation, which is their goal." He then goes on to describe what happens when people don't keep to their pledges. In commenting on the next verse, he writes, "The faults that result from an impaired discipline have been described by the Buddha himself. One will not listen to the holy teachings, and what one hears will quickly be forgotten. Realization of the grounds and paths will not arise. It is also said, when discipline is disregarded, one will go to the lower realms. Great learning will be no protection. And again, as it is said in the Manjushri Mula Tantra, regarding those whose discipline is spoiled, the mighty sage did not declare them able to accomplish Tantra. But then Kunzan Palzan goes on to wish, may all who spoil their discipline and commit downfalls repair their actions sincerely and with strong remorse, confessing what is to be confessed and resolving not to fail again. At all times, may they purify their negative actions, and having done so, may they never in the immediate term be reborn in the lower realms. May they always be born among higher destinies, and taking monastic ordination, may they keep their discipline and practice purely and without decline. These lines recall to my mind what happens in Tibetan Buddhism when young children recognized as reincarnates of previous high masters, tulkus as they are called in Tibetan, are taken from their families to the monasteries to become monks and scholars. Usually, such youngsters are treated as minor gods. They have their own attendant or attendants, and often thrones, and everyone in the monastery bows down to them and stands aside when they appear. If they are recognized as a tulku of a recently departed master, they might also have many Western students who will rush from all over the world to pay homage. Of course, in their previous life in less degenerate times, they may have been brought up by stern teachers who saw to it that they kept their discipline strictly. In fact, to have become a great adept, they would have had to. But now, in a different body and situation, where everyone fawns over them and generally discipline has become more relaxed, they are easily spoiled. Not only may they not study well, but they may also take not so much notice of the discipline they're supposed to be following. You can imagine, for instance, what happens when a young boy whose life is supposed to revolve around long days of memorization, recitation, and study is given a computer with lots of games on it by devoted but not so wise Western disciples. Such adoration has happened, and the results with other concerns, not the least being Westerners themselves being recognized as tulkus, became so much of a problem that His Holiness the Dalai Lama has become unwilling to formally recognize tulkus. Today, there are recognized tulkus in all the Tibetan Buddhist traditions, the Sakya, Gelug, Kagyu, and Nyingma, as well as Jonang and Bodang, who serve the Dharma. It is also evident that amongst these tulkus, some are a disgrace, His Holiness has written in a statement on the issue of reincarnation. Now, this is just one example, and a rather localized one at that, of how monastic discipline can degenerate. We can think of others, for example, in countries like Sri Lanka, where monks have become politicians, or have collected riches for themselves from the offerings of the lay people. May all such behavior be avoided, says Shantideva, and monastics strive to keep their vows well, purifying any transgressions and being able to keep their vows better and better from life to life. Then he goes on, may the wise be honored and may they receive alms. May their minds be completely pure and may they be renowned in all directions. Kunzan Palden describes the wise like this. The eyes of correct discrimination are open when, as an active karmic effect similar to the cause, people have an unimpaired observance and are learned in the five sciences, especially the inner science of the Tripitaka. They are able to uphold and propagate the precious doctrine of the victorious one, the source of all happiness and welfare. Which basically means that the wise are those who, having created the necessary causes, are able to keep their discipline well, and are also very well versed in the five fields of knowledge. These five fields of knowledge were counted as important in ancient India and are linguistics, logic, medicine, the creative arts, and metaphysics philosophy, the last being the inner science of the Tripitaka. That is, of course, the three baskets of the Vinaya, or rules of discipline, the Sutra, or discourses of the Buddha, and the Abhidharma, or text on philosophy and psychology. In her book, The Inner Kalachakra Tantra, Vesna Wallace, assistant professor in the Religious Studies Department of the University of California, writes that in early Buddhism, the study of creative arts, craftsmanship, writing, and so on were regarded as, and I quote, vulgar fields of knowledge, which are studied only by lay people. Our monks who wanted to study such subjects had to look outside the monasteries for teachers. However, with Mahayana Buddhism and the ideal of the Bodhisattva who worked for every benefit for all beings, those aspiring to the ideal had to have a much greater knowledge than just the elimination of spiritual ignorance. Also, to become a Buddha, one had to work towards omniscience or all-knowing. So monastic education then started to include other fields of knowledge. For the eradication of every kind of ignorance, as Wallace puts it. People who thus became knowledgeable in all the fields of knowledge, according to Kunze and Paldon, are best able to fully teach and spread the Buddha's teachings and help others. For a modern example, you might recall that in an earlier program, we quoted Pema Chodron, saying that her teacher, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, was proficient in all kinds of knowledge. She wrote, "He was interested in using everything on the path to enlightenment, calligraphy, filmmaking, poetry, flower arranging, tea ceremony, archery, horseback riding, theater, photography, and dance. Although he grew up as a titled person in a monastery, he knew how to make a drum and do gilding, tanka painting, and sculpture." Now, such people are on a higher plane than most of us, writes Kunze and Paldon. So may they be honored and respected, and may they effortlessly find whatever they might need, dharma robes, begging bowl, provisions, and so forth. May they be free of pride with respect to their own qualities and knowledge, and free of jealous rivalry with regard to the qualities of others. May they have neither contempt for other people nor scorn for the doctrines of other schools. May they turn away from all actions that lead to abandoning the dharma and the faults of distorted discipline. May their minds be utterly pure, and may their reputation for wisdom and pure observance spread in all directions. A good explanation of this passage can be found in a report of teachings on the life of Milarepa, given by the 16th Karmapa, His Holiness Urgyen Tinley Dorje, on the website www.kagyumonlam.org. His Holiness gave the teachings at the Mahabodhi Temple in Bodh Gaya at Christmas time in 2009, and the part relevant to our discussion today starts with the story of Milarepa and a Geshe. That is a monk in the Gelugpa tradition of Tibetan Buddhism who had successfully completed between 20 and 30 years of intense study at a great monastery. The Geshe's name was Thakpua, and he developed a great animosity for Milarepa, the great enlightened yogi. The report on His Holiness the Galwa Karmapa's teachings goes like this. His enmity towards Milarepa grew after Milarepa embarrassed him in front of his benefactors by refusing to return his prostration. Geshe Thakpua retaliated by asking Milarepa to explain a text of Buddhist logic, knowing full well that Milarepa would not have studied it. However, Milarepa turned the tables on him. Consequently, Geshe Thakpua plotted to poison him. Using the story of Geshe Thakpua as his starting point, His Holiness investigated what it means to abandon the Dharma. He explained that Geshe Thakpua was a Kadampa Geshe. These were usually exemplary and well-qualified lamas. But Geshe Thakpua's downfall came about because of his pride. It was true that he had some learning, but he became arrogant and gave up the Dharma. Because of his arrogance, he looked down on others and was unable to recognize Milarepa's qualities. When Milarepa shamed him in the presence of his sponsors, he felt there was no alternative but to kill him, and so began to plot how he could poison him. Galwa Karmapa warned of the dangers of holding partisan and sectarian views, such as, "I belong to this lineage," or "I follow this teacher," which deny the value and validity of other teachers or schools. He suggested that this was a form of abandoning the Dharma, and as such, counts as worse than the five heinous deeds, killing your mother, killing your father, killing an arhat, harming a Buddha, and causing schism in the Sangha. Abandoning the Dharma is defined as denying something was Dharma when it was, maintaining something was Dharma when it wasn't, and likewise claiming that a genuine Dharma practitioner was not practicing Dharma, and vice versa. If one did any of these, one had abandoned the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Abandoning the Dharma is described as cutting the root of all virtuous actions. The consequence is all positive things are finished. The person may still perform positive deeds, according to some, but it would be very difficult for them to attain enlightenment, His Holiness explained. In contrast, so long as they did not abandon the Dharma, even the negative karma of someone who had committed hundreds of thousands of negative deeds could be purified. His Holiness gave further examples of giving up the Dharma, such as people who allege that the Mahayana tradition is not true Buddhism, that the Vajrayana tradition comes from Hinduism, or that the Tantras are not true Dharma. If you deeply criticize or make this type of allegation, he warned, you have given up the Dharma. In Tibet, there were many sects and old and new Tantras, but all of the methods taught were relevant teachings for the two accumulations. Some may not suit certain people, but this was not a sound reason for those people to denigrate them. In differentiating between what was Dharma and what was not Dharma, the significant factor was whether a teaching was of benefit. It also had to be appropriate to the capacity of that person. If the teaching was unsuitable, for example, teaching emptiness to someone who is not prepared, it could cause harm, confusion, and misconceptions. Mistaken logic might lead someone then to say about certain teachings, oh, this is bad, or this is good. In that case, there was the danger of committing the fault of abandoning the Dharma. Indeed, the Chakrasamvara Tantra warned that if you were unable to understand profound teachings, you should not criticize them. It was important to understand that it was not always possible for the intellect to take the measure of the profound Dharma. Gyalwa Karmapa transferred his focus to non-Buddhist religions. To criticize a non-Buddhist religion, he warned, could be similar to breaking samaya. The non-virtuous actions include harsh speech. If you were to say harsh words about other religions or other schools, it was possible you would break the root samaya of Tantra. Then there was the issue of disputes between Buddhist schools. These had arisen early in the history of Buddhism, leading to the establishment of 18 separate schools. Buddha himself had predicted that Buddhist schools would fight amongst each other, but such arguments and disputes, His Holiness warned, were destroying Buddhism. It was essential that the Buddhist Sangha live in harmony, he emphasized. In places where the Sangha argued and fought, the positive energy of the place was destroyed. Positive spirits lost their power, and negative energy became very strong, adversely affecting all the sentient beings in that environment. Such a place required an enlightened being to turn the wheel of Dharma three times in order to restore harmony. If the Vinaya holders are in harmony, the Sangha is worthy of worship. Unlike Buddha and Dharma, the Sangha can actually accept offerings, but they need to maintain pure conduct and practice the three trainings. In ancient India, it is said, the Sangha kept pure ethical discipline, and lay people attained enlightenment by making offerings to them. We need to be wary of criticizing other schools out of ignorance, commented Gyalwa Karmapa. Often, our arrogance leads us to make mistaken judgments of what is good and what is bad. Such biased criticism can send us to the hell realms. We have the opportunity to practice the Dharma. We should not waste that opportunity by committing non-virtuous actions, by becoming partisan and criticizing others. His Holiness illustrated the point. It takes four people to carry a heavy copper pot. If one person tries to carry it alone, they will drop it. He advised everyone to study all Buddhist traditions, and then they will have a comprehensive view of the Dharma. In order to become enlightened, we must obtain omniscience. If we're not open to studying everything, how can we ever attain omniscience, he asked. It is said that there's nothing that a bodhisattva does not study because they have to be able to help everybody. The reason for becoming a Buddha is in order to be of benefit to all sentient beings, vast as space. If you do not have this motivation, you become an arhat. Even understanding emptiness can be done through different approaches. Now, it becomes obvious through these teachings that we have to be very careful about how we approach the teachings of the Buddha. I must say that I have doubts about some things, but I also have to admit that my knowledge is very scanty, so it's better to keep my mouth shut and engage in much more study. I also think that when we approach the Dharma from the perspectives of a foreign culture, we are immediately put at a disadvantage. Of course, some practitioners fall very easily into the tradition they have chosen. But Westerners schooled in science and technology, encountering Tibetan Buddhism, for instance, could find its esoteric and almost fantastical descriptions and practices unintelligible, confusing, intimidating, or just plain weird. Also, I've had discussions with people interested in Buddhism about the role of DNA versus that of mind in forming what people are. Those steeped in the science of DNA can find it very difficult to understand how mind, moving from one incarnation to the next, can carry predispositions with it. We're in the process of forming the Dharma of the West in much the same way as the Chinese form Chan, the Japanese Zen, and so on. While in this process, we have to be careful not to get stuck in any one Eastern tradition and proclaim it the sole heir to Buddha's teachings. As His Holiness the Karmapa says, in differentiating between what is Dharma and what is not Dharma, the significant factor is whether it is of benefit or not. For a Tibetan Buddhist to say that Zen is not really Buddhism would be to deny Zen's obvious ability to bring benefit, and so it would be abandoning the Dharma. I have heard of Westerners who follow Tibetan Buddhism poo-pooed Theravada as inferior, and also a Theravadan monks once told me that Mahayana is not really the teaching of the Buddha. These are the kind of attitudes we should really avoid unless we have the power to see back to the Buddha's time. And how many of us have that? Now, after that slight digression from the content of Shantideva's text, but not the meaning, let's return once more before the program ends. In his next verse, he says, "May beings not experience the misery of lower realms, and may they never know any hardships. With a physical form superior to the gods, may they swiftly attain Buddhahood." And Kunzen Peldon clarifies this verse with, "May those who have poor discipline, and indeed anyone else, never have to suffer the three lower realms in their lives to come. And without great toil and difficulty, may they attain a human existence endowed with freedoms and advantages, which from the point of liberation is far better than a divine existence, and quickly attain perfect Buddhahood." We must end the program there, but we'll discuss that a little further next time. Please dedicate any positive energy from the program to the enlightenment of all beings. Thank you for being here today, and please join us again next week. Goodbye. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Why hang I here?
It was the money or too near the cartoonies that provoked me. Woke me from the slumber of wondering where I was going, stumbling through the...